and theorize or make it into some kind of religious doctrine or some ideal. But the important thing that we do is to try to understand and to recognize what is truly generous within our own mind, rather than idealize it as some kind of something that happens in some very extreme way. Because in our human realm, generosity is something that we all admire. And that when people are generous, that makes life much easier than when people are selfish, miserly, only thinking of their own needs and have no concern for anyone else. And in Buddhism, the path is one of based on dana or generosity, which is being able to give, to share what you have with others. Of course, this comes at different levels, but on the material level, on the intellectual level, on the emotional level. Sometimes generosity is just considered on the level of material offerings. And in the a Buddhist country, for example, the country that I lived in for many years was Thailand. This virtue is given a kind of priority within their culture. It's a kind of foundation for their cultural attitudes. And I think all of us who've been to Thailand or live with Thai people are oftentimes quite impressed and oftentimes quite amazed by the generosity that is generated towards oneself. Because in our own cultures, in my own culture, I don't expect that level of generosity on the material level. Even though generosity was a part of my cultural programming, it wasn't given the position of number one. It was, I think, considered a nice thing to do, but was not given a lot of emphasis. Where in Buddhist culture, it's given almost the on the level of virtuousness and that as a kind of priority that is available to people from all levels of the society. Generosity is the very beginning, the very foundation of some kind of spiritual development. So in the hierarchy of development, in Buddhist terms, you have dana, which is the first one, sila, which is morality, the second, bhavana, which is meditation, the third, the three levels. And so it's always interested me living in a Buddhist society, putting dana as a kind of prerequisite, the kind of given priority, the kind of basis for spiritual development. Because my background from the American Christian European attitude was that morality was what you started with and then worked up from there. And so it was almost like this is my felt, that without some kind of moral commitment, then spiritual development was, you had to go that route and start from there, and oftentimes dismissed or denied anyone who didn't live up to, say, the moral standard that you that was acceptable to your community. And so, in living in Thailand, I used to wonder because the sila or morality is the second stage, dana being the first. The attitude there is that no matter how bad you are, no matter how mean or low or criminal your profession might be or the way you live your life, there are moments of good-heartedness where you can share what you have with somebody else. And so that is to be encouraged, rather than to put religious development on such a level, let's say, of high moral commitment, where then that would only make it impossible for some people to even make the most of those moments in their life where they have no moral commitment, but they can, in some generous moment, some bright flash of their lifetime, suddenly share what they have with somebody else. And so I always like that idea very much, because I can see how encouraged one is by the fact that if we have a standard that's for spiritual development based on a very high moral standard or meditation standard, then it tends to make, spiritual development something that is very exclusive and possible only for those who can relate to morality easily, or hold themselves within moral restraint without any difficulty, or who easily take to things like prayer or meditation. Morality or sila or dana also can be taken to put on the very basic level of just sharing something that you have with somebody else. And it's also the act of giving without expecting reward for it. So generosity isn't like I'm giving you something and that means puts you in some kind of debt to me. I've given you this and I expect you to do something for me in the future. Or dana isn't a virtue as long as we think I'm stacking up merits in the heavens above, so that if I do all these good deeds, then the next lifetime I will have a better rebirth. Some people think like that, which is certainly better to be generous for selfish reasons than not to be generous at all. But it still isn't the pure state of generosity, because the act of generosity comes, the purity of that particular act comes through the care and the wish to give to help somebody else without thinking that they should do something for you. It's a reward in itself, because pure dana or pure generosity is a kind of joyfulness that we experience in life. I notice this from my own experiments with generosity, that when there is this total relinquishment in the present, you know, giving without any plot to get something back, then that is like a moment of pure joy. That's what I call joyousness. When it sinks into, well, now I hope to get something back, then the joy is gone, isn't it? There's no joy in any selfish concern. Selfishness takes the joy out of life, where generosity brings joy into it as experience. Selfless giving, selfless sharing. But then we can become too high-minded about selfless giving, due to the fact that when we do, we give something, and then the thought arises in our mind, now I've given them something, maybe they'll do something for me. Then we tend to fear that we've kind of destroyed or nullified our merit, our generosity. But that's okay, too. The thing is to make the intention quite pure. For example, what we do, say, with intention, is it comes from a rational place in our life where we can deliberately choose on a rational plane to make our intention, say, this pure this pure act of giving, selfless giving. Now that's an intention. It's a rational choice put on you know, which is an ideal. It's a very high ideals, are, of course, the peak, the top. And that's how to use ideals, to use them in a deliberate way as the guiding star for action. So then we learn to trust in that ideal, in that intention we have, pure, unselfish intention for generous acts, generosity in the world. Then when we do have these moments of giving and then maybe a selfish thought arises, that's all right, because our intention's pure. And the selfish thought we can also recognize as something not to grasp or not to believe. Because so many modern people tend to distrust themselves a lot, so they think every generous act is really done for a selfish reason, because it's easy to always put yourself on the kind of the lowest possible level. The meanest, most selfish explanation is the true one. We easily sink into the belief that honesty is admitting that we're absolutely selfish and horrible, mean-hearted, untrustworthy, screwed up people. I'm being honest right now. But is that real honesty, or is that oftentimes just a feeling, a kind of feeling we have about ourselves that comes and goes? And also, I tend now to trust, even though selfish thoughts might arise, to trust in the intention rather than be caught up in endlessly analyzing and doubting myself about the purity of my motive, because that you just go around in circles if you're endlessly trying to figure out what was your real intention for doing that kind act, and then well, you did something good for somebody, and then later on you go home and then somebody says, well, I think that's a need, a psychological need of yours, that you somehow need to be generous to make you feel okay about yourself. And then you think, oh, well, that sounds true. Yes, yes. And then you get caught up thinking that you're just being kind and generous to other people because you're psychologically needy. And then you can, not to deny even that possibility, but that's not your intention. And you see what I mean? And also, and to learn to trust your intention, because your emotions will doubt your intention. So what I found very helpful is to make these intentions in a completely rational way, not when I'm even inspired. Like if I'm inspired, you know, oh, I love Buddhism, it's so wonderful, that meditation retreat just was so perfect, and I was so calm, and I want to devote the rest of my life to Buddha Dhamma and be a bodhisattva, and I'm going to not be selfish anymore, and then that's from an inspired mind, isn't it? You know, this really high state. And then inspiration doesn't last, you know, then it drops. And oftentimes because of the higher you go on the inspired level, the lower you drop. Feeling totally useless, and you did have a moment of clarity, but now you're lost in the usual confusion that you identify with. Don't believe that kind of thinking, because that's not really the way it is. That's how it seems according to the conditioned worldly mind. Also, this intention comes learning to trust yourself more rather than endlessly criticize or doubt yourself. Because people nowadays tend to live in a world that is very critical and very willing, very willingly dwell on what's wrong with themselves, with each other, with the society. And so and this is quite believable in so many ways because everybody's doing it. But that is, and so we obsess our conscious daily life with oftentimes what's wrong, and oftentimes what's wrong with oneself. And it becomes obsessive. Where generosity is a way of breaking out of that obsession, a generous act. Here, say, on a Sunday morning, when you get like the Thai or the Sri Lankan or Cambodian communities coming to give dana, or the English, that sense of joy of giving is there. It has a whole kind of quality all its own, where these people come to give, not to get anything back. You know, they're just happy to offer this food to the Sangha. And they're not asking for any reward. So even, in the monastic system in Thailand, you're not even supposed to say thank you, a monk, when somebody gives them something. Because that means you're giving them something back. And this was very hard when I was as Americans, we're always saying thank you for everything. I got so bad saying thank you that somebody step on my toe and I say thank you. I'm totally heedless, you know. You think everything that happens to you, say thank you, automatic. And then in Thailand, they'd say people would offer food, and I keep wanting to say thank you, and I'd have to restrain myself, because every time I did, they look a bit shocked, like I was doing something I shouldn't be doing. It's like taking away the fullness of their merit. I think they quite understood the obsessive need that I had to say thank you. But we'd also give blessings. But these blessings are a part of a tradition and offered freely rather than compulsively. In the kind of cultural, mythological basis for Thai culture, it's based on the Jataka story of Prince Vaisantara, or the Bodhisattva Buddha, the Buddha to be, that was his last rebirth, and he perfected the paramita, or the virtue of dana paramita, or generosity. And this story is a basis for the Thai culture. And if you don't understand this story, if you take it too literally from a Western way of interpreting myth and legend, oftentimes you don't appreciate this story, because it does look a bit strange and a bit foolish to a Western mind. But when you start contemplating in terms of myth, and in Joseph Campbell's books, he tries to explain the mythological way of thinking that humans used before they became scientific. And of course, Christianity is very much based on this way of thinking, on the way of metaphor and legend and symbol, and that which appeals to our emotional natures. And so this story of Prince Vaisantara is the story of generosity taken to absurdity in terms of a Western mind. And even modern Thai people think it's a bit absurd, you know, because Prince Vaisantara was born to a king, and he was as he grew up, he knew that this lifetime had to be devoted to giving away everything, not to have whatever anyone would ask for, he'd give it to them. And so he started out when they had this elephant that was a great, auspicious, miraculous creature that kept his kingdom safe from drought. So all the other kingdoms around Prince Vaisantara's kingdom were had no rain, and there was no crops, and people were desperate. But his kingdom, because of this miraculous elephant, had no problem with the rain. So eventually these Brahmins came, and Brahmins in the Jataka stories are always kind of not very nice people. So forgive me, any of you who are Brahmins. That's part of the myth, I think, is that some Brahmins from neighboring kingdom asked the prince for this magic elephant, and he gave it to them. So then people, I guess, were beginning to wonder about the prince, you know, he's giving away the treasures of the kingdom, and he ends up giving away everything, his wife and children, in fact. And that really upsets modern people, and, you know, it's not politically correct behavior at all. Give away your wife, children, to just anyone that asks. And gave his children away to this really scruffy, degenerate Brahmin that, you know, is really disgusting. And his wife, fortunately... one of the gods, Indra, disguised himself and came down and asked for Prince Vaisantara's wife, and he gave. So he was in pretty good hands, or she was. But Prince Vaisantara didn't, you know, wasn't coming from any doubt about the act of generosity. So even though, but what this does imply in terms of myth is the willingness to give away what you love the most, in the knowledge or the faith that this is what is needed, this is what is good, because in the story itself, if you follow it and you learn to understand it in terms of myth, then you realize Prince Vaisantara isn't coming from any doubt or any kind of cynicism about what he's doing. He knows, even though it's obvious when they perform this Jataka story in Thailand, that this is a very difficult thing to do, to give away what you love, trusting the fact that this is the right thing to be doing. In terms of a practical mind, it seems irresponsible, naive, one could, if you're trying to relate to this legend or this myth in terms of a modern attitude towards society, what's politically correct behavior, you would definitely have a lot to criticize Prince Vaisantara for. But in the end, of course, it all turns out all right. He gets everything back, his children, his wife, elephant, kingdom. The villain that maltreated, abused Prince Vaisantara's children is his comeuppance, as he eats too much at a banquet. He eats so much that his stomach explodes. And the Thais find that very, very funny. You know? The idea that you just lose your mindfulness so much that you'd eat till your stomach, sometimes one feels like it. Well, myth is like that. It isn't about real people like Prince Vaisantara. They filmed this in Thailand about 10 years ago. Made videos of it, of this legend, and you can see that the Prince Vaisantara is a very tall, handsome man that has incredible dignity, and he has great kind of you know, feeling. One feels this sense of compassion in him and this generosity, but also you realize that he's not a real human being. He's a mythological being. In order to make a point in terms of this virtue of generosity. And of course then in myth they can take things to absurd extremes, because that's one of the things that you can do with stories. They don't have to make sense in terms of everyday life, dirty dishes in the kitchen sink kind of dramas, or in the soap operas that people gravitate to now, but fairy tales and legends, myths, stories of this kind can be just stimulate imagination. But also, it's done to allow us to, say, experience the beauty of a moment of generosity. Because we can be generous compulsively, just do it because we think we should do it, or to do it and not really contemplate, not really be with what we're doing. It's so easy to do one thing in a perfunctory way and then not to really contemplate, reflect upon the very act itself. So generosity can be spontaneous, but also we need to reflect upon it, to recognize the result of generosity. So that once you really acknowledge and recognize the result, then you're not just being generous because of some compulsive sense of duty or because you're afraid of being stingy, but because it is its own reward. It's something that you fully are doing completely in the awakened state that you love to do. Generosity in terms of like in terms of a monk going on an alms round. You collect food from whoever, from a criminal, from a prostitute, from the lowest caste, from anybody who at that moment wants to give you something that they're out of that spontaneous goodness. And the monks aren't supposed to deny that person that opportunity. They say, sorry, you're not good enough to give me dana. Would be an arrogant statement, wouldn't it? We're not even allowed to choose the kind of food we get. So if people, if you want to be a vegetarian, but you're on the alms round and people offer you meat, then you accept meat. Or whatever that is allowable in terms of food. We're not allowed to encourage killing of animals for food, or to tell anyone that we want to eat meat or anything like that. But that we're not trying to encourage slaughter of animals, but the emphasis is on the act of giving rather than on the quality of the substance. And this I found very helpful for me in Thailand, where, say, the majority of the people are non-vegetarian. And in the village life where I lived in the Northeast, the people eat a lot of things that we don't eat in the West. So you're faced with having to eat creatures that you, not because you're vegetarian, but because you've just never eaten things like this. And then to put it in the terms of receiving rather than your emotional reaction to the food that's being given. It helps to reflect your own emotional state in the present. Over the years, say, of monastic life, then I've been able to get better perspective on that feeling that I have, and seeing dana as in terms of the ideal of the generous act rather than of the object that's being offered, being glad or disgusted by the thing that's being offered. But in an act of mindfulness in the present moment, then the mind does include both. And so this is where I think this is a very helpful way of thinking, is to see that in the present moment, if we use our intuition in the present, that this present moment includes whatever is happening, both intellectually, emotionally, instinctually. So, like when you're caught in your idealistic, rational mind, then you're caught in the kind of linear progression of from bad, from the worst to the best. And we see things in terms of their quality and relate them to ideas that are better or standards that are better or worse. And so when we're caught into this thinking mind all the time, then we're always seeing life in a very divisive way. Life becomes just an endless kind of attempt to control things in order to try to protect oneself from the apparent dangers and harmful things that are possible in daily life in a present situation or possibly in the future. But with intuition, then the intuitive moment isn't necessarily discriminative. You know, discrimination can be also a part of the present moment. It is not the moment itself. So in the Buddha's teaching of mindfulness, then this state of open awareness, intuitive awareness in the present, allows us to both accept, say, make the generous act in terms of dana, to offer, to share what we have with somebody else, and to accept also maybe any emotional feelings or selfish thoughts we might be having at the same moment. You see, so it's not like with intuition we're embracing the whole thing rather than trying to say control the present moment into fit into some ideal we have. So in this way, more and more, as we release our tendency to control life, manipulate conditions, and then to continually discriminate and think about it, we find a natural state of where generosity is a part of the way we relate to daily life experience. It's not something we do as an act that I must be generous, and therefore today is my day to be generous. It's not coming, even though that it can include that thought. But generosity is just a natural way of relating to other beings, both to the human world, the animal world, the society, the planet, and the modern ecology. Caring for the planet can be generous position. It can be from a very controlled and manipulative idealism. Or it can be an act of faith, an act of trust coming from that developing of generosity. Selfishness is based on the thinking process. To be a self, you have to think. You have to be attached to thoughts and ideas about self. And just interesting to see in the past few years how much meditative advice and psychological advice has come forth in the relinquishment of thinking and the emphasis on silence. And where I don't remember this as being even a subject considered as possible in, even 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I remember when I first became when I was a novice monk in Thailand, and I had this insight that I had to stop thinking. Suffering is, it was a bit simplistic, but it was because at that time I didn't have the experience in meditation to really put it in a context of wisdom. The kind of insight was made in a kind of simplistic style, like stop thinking. That's all I have to do is stop thinking, which seemed quite a profound insight. But then to stop thinking was not an easy thing to do. So I remember telling somebody, and I went over. I was in Nong Khai. I went over to the Laotian capital one day, to Vientiane, and met somebody I'd known when I was a layman, a Westerner, and they asked me what I was doing, and I said, "Oh, I've been practicing meditation in just across the river in Nong Khai," and really had an insight. And what is that? It's stop thinking. And this man really looked panic-stricken. He kind of fled, you know. It's too much. Well, he must have thought I was really, it had gone to my head. Maybe I was a bit cracked. But then going back to the monastery and trying to stop thinking as an act of will didn't work. That because the insight was on the intuitive level, and then grasping it on the intellectual level of just, all you have to do is stop thinking. Then grasping that idea, stop thinking, and then what am I left with is a kind of willful attempt to make my mind stop thinking, which is based on grasping and on an idea and on grasping rather than on the experience of insight. So then finding out that you couldn't do it that way, then gradually the development or the pavana, they're based on the sila or the moral commitment, because after that I committed myself to the life of a bhikkhu. When I had that insight, I was a novice, and the following year I became a bhikkhu and went to stay with Ajahn Chah, who had this was famous for his moral discipline. So moral discipline became, I saw as a necessity, as a foundation. So from, and dana, say, where was the dana in this life? Well, I found out also that basically I was, my spiritual life was based on a strong sense of selfish desire to attain. So the first year as a novice, I reached the summum bonum of selfishness, the ne plus ultra of selfish obsession, where I was so caught in just the obsession with myself that it was such a painful experience. That actually saw realized just the horror and the misery of selfish attachment. Because in that this tendency to want peace, to want not want to be involved, not wanting to hear, not wanting to share. Just wanting to live in a state where nothing that the things that you don't want bothering you are not present. You can control your life in a way that only you can only surround yourself with what you like and feel good about, and completely kind of shut out anything that is unwanted and unsuitable towards this selfish goal. So I found that this meditation alone, very much being alone, brought this selfishness to this peak. And this was seen in just when I contemplated the generosity that I was receiving from the other people around me. Because in this meditation monastery in Nong Khai, every day they'd send me food. I didn't even have to go on alms round. A young Thai novice would come with a tiffin carrier of very nice food to give me every day. And they'd bring a flask of tea or coffee or something, or occasionally they'd bring some things that were allowed, and I didn't have to go and seek these out. These were brought to me every day. The fact that the whole society around me seemed to be supporting me in this endeavor. The monks at the monastery, the lay people, one felt the whole society was there kind of encouraging me to practice meditation. So I had a tremendous sense of security and of support that was coming from the generosity or the dana of the people, of the society, of the monks in the monastery, of the nuns. There were a lot of Thai nuns at the monastery who were involved in preparing this food. And so then one day I remember just getting so kind of, when you're in this state of isolation and sensory deprivation, you often feel very blissful. And this state of bliss was something that I really liked. And I found when people started talking to me, I'd lose this state of bliss. So then, fortunately, nobody could speak English in this monastery. And I couldn't speak Thai, it wasn't too much of a problem, but sometimes people would come, and they'd like the women that prepare the food, and they'd come and offer it, and they'd kind of hang around like they wanted me to say something, and I just kind of take it. And I knew I wasn't supposed to say thank you, and I just kind of turn my back on them and go inside. And I'd feel that. And sometimes monks would want to come and ask me how I was doing, and I remember one time seeing them coming from a distance and running into the woods, hiding. I didn't want to talk to them. So, and this kind of behavior did make me wonder about what the holy life was all about. If I was going to be such a selfish and ungrateful person, if this is what was happening to me, because I became addicted to bliss. You can become a bliss addict. So this was, and I realized, and that's, I didn't quite put it in those terms, and I never thought of myself as an addict. Now I would, but because addict implied to other things, but I realized that's what had happened. I'd become addicted to bliss. And therefore, I mean, the bliss was like a state in which your mind was, just very in this state of just joyfulness and happiness, peacefulness. And everything seemed wonderful, and you couldn't, there's no negativity in the mind. And then people started, if people would come, they might put doubts into my mind, or might say something that might grate on me, or I might feel, you know, because I couldn't speak Thai, I'd feel kind of frustrated. I'd feel frustrated because I didn't know what to say. So I'd get this feeling of frustration. So if I could just leave everybody behind, then I could more or less maintain this state for a long period. So, contemplating that, then I realized that I'd either have to spend my life, you know, completely shutting everyone out, which was certainly something I considered. But then fortunately, I did meet disciple of Ajahn Chah, and they kind of convinced me to practice in another way. Because in the monastic life with Lungpo Cha, the life was built, was based around generosity, basically, in sharing the life. We all helped each other, very communal lifestyle, based on a very high standard of moral commitment, the Vinaya, which I knew I needed, because I tend to be a kind of one who easily can justify lesser ways of behavior. I'm quite easy at that. I'm not particularly, you know, like a principled person that's very stuck onto high standards. I realize I have a mind that can justify almost anything if I want to. So you've got to find a way to come to grips with that, and come and learn to understand that kind of behavior. And then also the fact that Lumpa Cha's emphasis was on mindfulness in daily life. The bhavana wasn't based on sensory deprivation or on a high level of concentration, but on mindfulness in the very lifestyle you were living. And so it was learning to do things and eat your food, and we had to make robes, and we had to do all kinds of practical things. The cleanliness of the monastery was part of it. The relationships with the monks, with the nuns, with the lay people were all a part of the whole experience of bhavana. So in this way, one found the bhavana level very complete, very full, because it included all the other aspects of your life, reflecting, observing, awakened awareness, this intuitive awareness with the experience of your life as a monk in this monastery with these people, with these things. So then also in the Mahayana traditions, they emphasize the Bodhisattva ideal, which is another kind of expression of generosity and compassion, isn't it? Of self-sacrifice, of giving up your bliss for the welfare of all sentient beings. And in Mahayana, they take it to the most extreme possible metaphors a human being could possibly think up. Such as the last blade of grass. I will not take final nirvana until the last blade of grass is liberated. That is very moving, but to my mind, it makes it almost impossible to, especially when you've got so much grass as you do here in England. We have so much grass here at Amravati. But in terms of myth, isn't it? It's allowable. Those kind of metaphors are allowed, because they're not to be taken literally, but in terms of intention, to relinquish any selfish intention, even in the life of monasticism, that I'm going to get my nibbana because I'm fed up with life on this planet. I've seen the stupidity of it all, and I have this world weariness, and I'm just going to go for nibbana in this life. And if you don't bother, well, that's your problem. That's one way. And I've thought like that many times. I thought, I'm just going to go for it myself. If you, you know, the rest of you don't bother, that's your business. And then that also is coming from another sense of self, isn't it? I'm doing this, and you, if you don't do it, then that's your business. It's still based on the thought process, and on a still a very powerful sense of self and doing. But then in terms of generosity, one feels moved by the bodhisattva, the willingness to sacrifice personal privilege or personal bliss or personal salvation, liberation, nibbana, for the welfare of others. And then you realize that ultimately the personal thing has to go anyway. And in the development of meditation, personality view, the sense of an ongoing reified view of a self is seen through and is relinquished. That whole sense of self as a belief is recognized as the production of thought. And so even one's selfish intentions for spiritual development can be seen and recognized because sometimes they are quite subtle and even justified within the tradition that you identify with. Being a bodhisattva can also be another ego trip too. I'm a bodhisattva. And I'm not selfish like you are. So it's not identity or adopting the higher ideal or the more altruistic goal, but in really examining, understanding. Generosity allows a sense of trust and faith in the goodness of the universe that we live in. And I found this quite helpful to me, because modern life tends to make us very suspicious and feel that we're in a very dangerous universe that doesn't care about anybody, and that it has no benevolence. It's just survival, really, survival of the fittest, and just power struggling, selfishness, greed. Vanity is what human beings are all about. And we read those kind of things every day. Newspapers are full of that kind of that attitude of the meanness, the ugliness, selfishness of humanity, of the stupidity of humanity. But then I find in terms of my own spiritual development that I feel more in touch with the universe as benevolent than as being dangerous. And then the danger one sees as the ignorance of truth that I produce. The danger is not from external, but from internal reactivity, blindness, stupidity, ignorance. From here, not from out there. So that the actual liberation of the heart through bhavana, through meditation, then one feels this sense of benevolence supporting one in one's life, in your life. That there's a... the act of... Dana of generosity is also like the monastic form, say, alms mendicancy, where you, Buddhist monks and nuns are trusting in the goodness of others. So this act of trusting, of faith in the goodness, the benevolence of human beings. Makes that possible. Just from my experiment for the past 21 years living here in the UK. And that it's been an act of faith and trust in the goodness of humanity. And this was Ajahn Chah's approach when I asked him about whether I should accept this assignment to England, and his attitude was, if there are kind and good people in England, then you can live there, no problem. And what if they're not Buddhists? It doesn't matter. Kindness, goodness isn't the prerogative of Buddhists. It's human. So, and this, as far as my experience goes, has proven itself, because there's been no real problems in the terms of surviving, of living within the alms mendicant standard here in England. So that to me is not just based on an idealism and a hope, but on experience, my own experience, my own experiment with dana, and trust in the goodness and benevolence of the society that I'm living in. And so this also gives one this sense, it gives a strong foundation for spiritual development. Because from that trust and that faith in the goodness of the universe that we're living in, then restraint according to moral precepts, to sila, one doesn't find that so difficult, because there is a trust, and restraint isn't just an act of willful refusal to do things, but it becomes a simplification of life. You're trusting in a universal benevolence, and you're living your life with taking on a responsibility, and for simplifying, living in an honest and clear and simple way, which create the foundation for the pavana or the meditation or the spiritual development. So in that way, the dana, sila, pavana are like mutually supportive. It's not even like you do one, first you practice dana, then you do the sila, then you do the... That's the thinking mind, isn't it? That's when people do say you've got to practice sila in order to meditate, or you've got to develop dana first and then sila and then meditation, or then others think just meditation is all you need, you don't need sila or dana. And all these are various ways of interpreting it according to the brain, isn't it? The thinking mind. But in terms of actual liberated moments, conscious moments of liberation, of enlightenment, you see all three are joined in that moment, that it's a fulfillment of all of those, dana, sila, pavana. Again, to emphasize the intuition, intuitive awareness is a universal. It's non-discriminative. So, say, with intuitive awareness, mindfulness, then you can bring into consciousness what you're feeling, but it's not analytical. It's more or less the noting. It's like this. When you come from thinking, then you can only have one thought moment at a time. So the world becomes very much a linear experience, this then that, A and then B and then C. An intuitive moment includes the A, B, C all in one. It includes the dana, the sila, the pavana. It's realizing the timeless. the eternity. It's the realization of eternity in the present. And so we're always on that threshold in this human realm, incarcerated in a time-bound and death-bound form, such as the human body, with a strong conditioning process of thought and emotion, but with the potential for realizing eternity in the present. So if you think about it, it drives you a bit crazy. But if you learn to relax and trust in your ability to be awake and aware in the present, then all the differences, seemingly polarized opposites and opposites that are part of the conditioned realm, are contained within that. And your relationship to the world is one, say, of acceptance and compassion rather than of control and manipulation. So it's 3:00 now. I heard my little clock bleep. And it's saying tea time. And Lada and Cholada have both been making tea for this hour, next hour. So please, I want to invite you all to have a cup of tea. And then in about 20 minutes, as usual, if those who are interested, we can have a further session of questions and answers.